The House Elections Committee will come to order. We don't yet have a quorum. When we do, we'll move officially on some of the items before us. Members, you have before you, obviously, an agenda, and this is the intended order, as always. But I want to be sensitive to the fact that we have a snowstorm today, and we have three bills here that originate from Greater Minnesota, where I understand for each of them there's at least the potential of testifiers. So I'd like a show of hands for those folks who came from a good distance who probably need to get on the road pretty quickly. Are there people who fall in that category? Because if so, I want to be respectful of your time and the fact that you came here, and thank you for coming here to testify. So I think we are going to depart then from the order, and I hope folks who had hoped to be first up can just bear with us. I want to be respectful of your time, but we have people who need to get on the road, and I think that trumps. So why don't we just start, because I saw a cluster over by Representative Sawatzky. Why don't we start with her bill, and I will then move House File 801 be recommended pass and placed on the general register. House File 801. Representative Sawatzky. Representative Sawatzky, to your bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Simon and members. I'm Mary Sawatzky, and I thank you for hearing House File number 801. This bill would allow Candiwai County the option to make the offices of auditor, treasurer, and recorder appointed positions subject to an 80% vote of the county board in a reverse referendum. As you may or may not know, as of 2011, 25 counties have gotten special legislation to make certain offices appointed positions. And I would like to introduce two testifiers. Larry Kleindel is our city administrator, and Harlan Mattson is a county commissioner in Candiwai County.
County administrator.
What did I say?
City.
County administrator.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Mr. Kleindel, welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Larry Kleindel, Candiwai County Administrator.
Harlan Mattson, Candiwai County Commissioner and Chair of the Board.
Okay.
I'm Harlan, again, Harlan Mattson. I've served 19 years as a County Commissioner in Candiwai County and currently the Chair of the Board. Thank you certainly for allowing us to testify today before you, considering the importance of this bill, which, if passed, will allow a specified Candiwai County to proceed with the process to make the auditor, treasurer, and recorder appointed. Candiwai County commissioners have been studying the appointment process for a number of years, weighing the advantages and disadvantages. The board has concluded that this legislation will provide us with the greatest opportunity of flexibility and in how we structure our delivery services into the future. If passed, we would be able to look at all of the aspects of collections, elections, driver's license, tax billing, recording of documents, and all of the aspects together from a point of centralizing functions. The current system does not, in our opinion, offer us the efficiencies to allow, because each independent office operates independently in terms of staff, positions, and everything. Centralizing these functions, in our opinion, makes sense, particularly in today's expanding technology and ever-constrained resources. Candiwai County Board is committed. We are committed to making the most efficiency, the best customer service, and in providing the greatest value for the taxpayers' dollars that we collect. Candiwai County is also in the process of redesigning our structure. We have contracted an independent firm to do an analysis of many of our departments, and asking the questions is, how can we better use our staff, how can we better use technology? We've appointed committees of the administration, the board, and staff with challenges and charges to say, how are we going to position Candiwai County for the next 10, 20, and 30 years? The structure that we develop is an organizational structure that will outlast me in terms of my lifetime. That is extremely important in our estimation as board. Our organizational structure has a very direct impact upon our efficiency and our constituents. More departments, more department heads, and more constraints on the budgets that we deal with today. We can't rely upon what we have done yesterday or what we do today. We must plan for and shape the future. We know we're living in different times, and it is very important that we adjust to what is referred to as the new normal. Candiwai County understands the concept of doing more with less. For years, we in Candiwai County have partnered with the neighboring counties to deliver services and solving problems. The counties have worked together in a spirit of collaboration and cooperation and mutual trust within our commissioners and administrators. Aside from the opportunities open from this legislation to increase efficiency and streamline, the technical aspects of auditor, treasurer, and recorder jobs have continued to become more and more complicated and complex. Case in point, unlike the elected positions for sheriff and county attorney, candidates for the office of auditor, treasurer, and recorder require no previous education, training, or experience. To run for sheriff, the candidate must be licensed as a police officer. To run for attorney, the candidate must have passed the bar and be an attorney. To run for auditor, treasurer, recorder, the candidate needs to be a resident and 18 years old. This leaves the county board, and frankly, many times, the great apprehension during the election process, hoping the most qualified candidate will win. This leads to a philosophical question. Do we want to reduce the appointment, and does the appointment reduce voter rights? In our opinion as a board, voting in a democracy is voicing one's opinion who will represent them in a policy-making role of a governmental unit. In today's society, citizens want value and efficiency in their government. This legislation, if passed, will allow us to make the decision to appoint. It requires the county to follow a very specific process of a public debate and to move forward if the board believes it is in the best interest of the citizens and constituents. It requires the county to have a discussion and an open public meeting and to allow for public debate. If the decision is made to move forward, the public still has the right by reverse referendum to reverse this decision. In our opinion, it does not circumvent the public scrutiny. Appointed of elected officials is not new. The office of assessor, county engineer, coroner, surveyor, and clerk of court were once appointed offices. But as times change, the duties of these offices have become more technical, complex, requiring training for which the appointment was made. Candy High County Board is committed to, again, providing quality service at the most reasonable cost. We respectfully request this legislation be passed to help us accomplish that goal. The majority of this committee, ironically, represents counties that already have that appointment process in place. This is good legislation for our county and its residents. And we respectfully request, and I request on behalf of the county board, I ask for your support in passing this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Kleinel, do you have anything to add?
Yes, I would. I think before you, you have a letter that we received from the Chamber of Commerce. The Wimmer Lakes Chamber of Commerce has provided a letter of documentation of their unanimous support for their efforts to seek a statutory authority to make the offices of Kennewick County Recorder and the Kennewick County Auditor Treasurer appointed. The Wilmer Lakes Area Chamber of Commerce understands the importance of our support in the efforts of to request that Senator Lyakunin and Representative Mary Sawatsky support the bill in both the Senate and the House that supports such legislation. The Wilmer Lakes Area Chamber represents over 600 businesses and professional members throughout Kennewick County. As you know, the Wilmer Lakes area is a regional center for many entities, including hospitality, business and attractions, healthcare, business, industry, and agriculture, various forms of government and education. In addition to enhancing the quality of life in our area, we promote and advocate for an area-wide business community, which in turn contributes to a strong tax base in the Wilmer Lakes area as well as the state of Minnesota. We want to thank you for your efforts to continue to support our local government to make it more efficient and accountable to our community and as a good example for the rest of the state of Minnesota. And it says if the Wilmer Lakes area, the Chamber of Commerce can be of any further assistance, please do not hesitate to contact us. This legislation that's before you today, all it does is allow Kennewick County the opportunity to have this discussion. It does not make the issue happen. It allows us to have a discussion. Thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinel. I appreciate it. I want to go to Mr. McGrath here, Dan McGrath from Minnesota Majority, but I just want to – is Mr. McGrath here? Okay. Mr. McGrath, I noticed that you signed up to testify on, I think, all of these bills that are kind of in the same category. What I'd like – one time is sufficient, and I think it's only fair to you to make sure it's on the first bill and not the last one. So if you care to testify now, I think that would be appropriate. Mr. McGrath.
Thank Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dan McGrath, president of Minnesota Majority. I'm going to be brief on this and consider my testimony to apply to all of these bills that have to do with changing the position of county auditor or auditor-treasurer from an elected to an appointed position. I just wanted to get a couple seconds to testify on this just to make sure that this one point was raised. The county auditors, under our state election laws, are the chief election official in each county. They are an integral part of our election system statewide as a whole. So changing the political process by which they come into power and possibly reducing their accountability to the voters is something that should be taken very seriously with a great deal of study, I believe. So that's all I have to say on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Members, I think, especially those who have been here at the legislature, you know the nature of these bills. I think most of us have our minds made up either way on this issue. So I don't know if there's any pressing commentary from any member of the committee. I think you sort of know the drill on this species of bill. That's not to minimize the concerns of Candiota County or anyone else here, but the issues are recurring issues. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just more of a broad question, I guess, of you is maybe the roadmap here. We do have four bills that are fairly similar.
Right.
Is it your intention that we pass out each one of these? I think if I read through, it looks like one of these is kind of more of a blanket approach, or is it something that we should have a broader context, have an omnibus type situation, or do you intend to kind of do both?
Representative Sanders, I think I'm open to doing both. We will be marking up next week an omnibus bill, and we can choose what to put in it, and I'm open to putting bills like this in it, I would say. But today, the intention is to pass these out separately and individually, and I do want to be respectful to testifiers like the one on Representative Sawatsky's bills who have come from great distances to testify. So out of respect to them, I want to take some action, take a vote today on those bills. Seeing no further member questions or concerns, I'll renew my motion that House File 801 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sawatsky, and to the testifiers. The next bill we will go... I think we'll go with Representative Dill's bill, House File 919. I understand there's some testifiers who traveled a great distance as well. Representative Dill, thank you very much. And to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Simon. And I appreciate your indulgence. These folks are from Lake County that came down. They got a five-hour drive, and the snowstorm is headed that way, so appreciate that. I think you know everything there is to know about the bill. Questions.
Thank
I have
you,
the county
Representative
commissioner
Dill.
Here and the county administrator here as well.
Since your testifiers did come a long way, they might want to say something, but if not, that's okay. Sir, do you wish to comment? And if so, just introduce yourself for the record.
I don't believe that I have any great thing to add to this. My name is Brad Jones. I'm a Lake County commissioner. Our board passed a unanimous resolution in support of this. We would hope that you can support this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Huddleston, I presume?
Thank you for the opportunity to address this bill. I don't think there's really anything additional that I can add that wasn't already eloquently spoke by Larry and the commissioner from Candiota County.
All right. Thank you, sir, and thanks for coming so long a distance for this bill. I hope you have a good trip back. Any other members' comments, questions, or concerns? Okay. Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 919 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair Simon.
The next bill we'll take up is Representative Lean's bill, House File 920. And I'll move that House File 920 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Lean, welcome to your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill, House File 920, largely the same as the other two bills we just heard, except this is pertaining to Clay County. So it would be for the auditor, treasurer, and recorder positions that they would now be appointed based on four-fifths approval of the county commissioners. With me today, I have Clay County Commissioner Grant Whalen, and you know, it does sound like folks seem to know what the score is, seem to be on the same page. He does have a resolution that was approved by all of the county commissioners, so he may like to speak on that.
Commissioner, welcome. Just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Grant Whelan, Clay County Commissioner. I don't really have a lot to add. My esteemed colleague from Kandi Ohi County, I think, did an excellent job of representing the same issues that we're dealing with in Clay County. And as Representative Leon did point out, we do have a unanimous resolution from the Clay County Commission supporting this. So with that, we would appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thanks for driving over here today in bad weather. Hope you have a good trip back. Members, any comments or questions or concerns? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, question I have for you is, first of all, do you know the current statute for having the changing that from elected to appointed is?
Commissioner? Or Representative Lee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the way this bill is written is that it would have to go through a 4/5 vote of the county commissioners and that it would be subject to reverse referendum.
Representative Johnson.
Paulo, do you know what the current statute is? Not what your bill is, what the current statute is.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, could you be more specific as far as what part of the statute? I guess, no, to be fair, I'm not completely familiar with all of the language in statute.
Sure. You know, Representative Johnson, it might be good to refer to Ms. Dyson, who is a nonpartisan staff who might be able to answer that question.
It's my understanding right now they can do that, but it would have to go to an election to the people at this time.
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. There is a general law that applies for changing offices from elected positions to appointed positions, and it's subject to referendum up front. What the special law bills provide is for that it is done by the supermajority vote of the county board resolution public hearings, subject to reverse referendum, so that if people submit a petition, they can have a referendum on it. That's the primary difference between general law and special law.
Okay. So currently, right now, if they brought the vote, do the resolution and brought it to the people, for them to vote on it, whether they want it or not, they could do that without this special law?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes.
Representative Johnson.
One follow-up question. Have you attempted to do that at this time yet or not?
In Clay County, no.
Okay. My concern is taking away the right of the people since this is elected. I think it's better off to go to the people first and then instead of trying to circumvent the voters in your district.
Any other member comments, questions, or concerns? Okay, seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 920 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lean and Commissioner.
Thank you.
Have a good
you,
drive
Mr. Chair,
back.
Members.
We will next proceed to House File 637. Representative Halverson is it. She's going up. I'm hoping, Representative Sanders, that you've had a chance to look over the meeting minutes of February 28th.
I have, Mr. Chair, and I'll move those minutes.
Okay. Representative Sanders moves approval of the minutes of February 28th, 2013. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sanders. Representative Halverson, you care to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 637 and recommend that it be passed and moved on to public safety.
Committee on Public Safety. Okay, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm bringing forward this bill today. It's something that a number of you have probably seen before, as it did make its way through several committees last session as well. Representative Mike Benson was the chief author. He was a member of the Task Force on Election Integrity that was appointed by the governor. He was going to be here today to speak to this bill, but had another meeting and timing as such. However, I do have two other members of the Election Integrity Task Force that are here and prepared to give you background on the task force itself. Both Mr. Tom Ferber and Secretary of State Mark Ritchie are here, and they'll be able to speak to the bill. This bill basically just codifies the recommendations of the first report of the Elections Integrity Task Force. It's the same language that was heard, as I said, in several committees last year, and so basically what we're looking at is the third engrossment that was seen last year. And it's a bipartisan effort to address concerns that have been raised over the years about voting, particularly about the voting of people who may not be eligible to vote in Minnesota. So I can just very briefly give you a description of what this bill does, and then we can hear from the experts. So in Section 1, this is just based on the task force recommendations to notify the voters who register when they're likely ineligible that they get notified that they're not actually registered until they make that it clear whether or not they are eligible to vote. It changes a penalty for people who register illegally from a felony to a misdemeanor. It does not change those who cast a ballot or sign the election register, even if they don't cast a ballot. That remains a felony. And this particular provision, as I said, was bipartisan. And it seems to make sense that if somebody starts down the road of registering illegally, voting illegally, but changes their mind, it gives them a step and an incentive to stop, essentially, they've already committed a misdemeanor. Are they going to go on and commit the felony? The bill also, as per the recommendations, provides greater data sharing between the Department of Corrections and the Office of the Secretary of State, so that it's much clearer to the Office of the Secretary of State and to county auditors who might be ineligible to vote if they are a convicted felon who is out on probation. Historically, it hasn't been particularly clear to felons who are out on probation whether or not their civil rights have been restored. They've heard about it when they were convicted, and years may pass before they are out on probation. And there hasn't been anything in statute that requires notification of these felons so that they know whether or not they've had their right to vote restored. And this makes it much clearer. So there's less murkiness in terms of intent of the voter as well. This bill also changes regulations regarding who is required to investigate and prosecute. The legislature did a great job of drafting legislation that requires investigation by the county attorney, which is a body that doesn't actually do investigations. And so this changes it to the appropriate law enforcement agency to require those investigations of people who might vote illegally. It also provides more data sharing on the delivery of absentee ballots, so that absentee ballots are not delivered to somebody who is ineligible to vote. It clarifies the action that is needed to create the unlawful voting situation, so that if somebody signs the roster, it clarifies that that's the threshold of intent. They don't even have to actually cast the ballot, but if they've signed the roster, that essentially is the threshold for intent for committing that crime. It also, as I said, provides clarity to the person who is out on probation that their civil rights and their right to vote have not yet been restored while they are on probation, and so they get notification, which really helps to clarify the again, gives more clarification to whether or not this person is intending to commit a crime, because basically the prosecution is resting on whether or not there's intent, and this makes it much clearer. There also is some provisions for appropriations in this bill, and a fiscal note has been requested. So when this goes on to the Finance Committee, we'll get to hear about that. So,
thank you, Representative Halverson. I think the best thing now is to call up our Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie, for his testimony. Secretary Ritchie, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Mark Ritchie. I serve as your Secretary of State. I just want to add on to this excellent presentation of the bill by saying that it comes directly out of that task force, but of course this addresses a challenge that we face that has been in front of us for quite a while. As you know, every state has the right to have its own election laws, and all 50 states exercise that right pretty vigorously, especially in the question of when do you lose your right to vote and when is it restored with your civil rights. It's different in almost all states. Our neighbor to the west have a simple system that they've liked and they've had for 50 years. We had testimony from the Secretary of State of North Dakota. If you're in prison, you can't vote. If you're out, you can. And they, in fact, encourage people who are out to vote because they see that as part of reintegration and reducing recidivism. We have a different law in Minnesota. We have more of a tier. You cannot have your civil rights restored until you're completely off paper, and this could be decades, literally, but it's obviously been an issue. We've had task forces on this in the past long before me. This task force had its origins, especially in the 2008 election, when on Election Day, a young man in War Road very famously became kind of a poster child for the confusion in the system. He was young when he was sentenced to prison, still young when he got out, but finally old enough to vote. He called his probation officer and unfortunately got the voicemail, said, hey, I'm getting my life together. I'm trying to be an excellent citizen. I'm putting myself back into my community. He happened to be a very strong supporter of Senator Coleman and Senator McCain, but he said, I'm going down to vote like a good citizen. His probation officer got that message, called him immediately, said, no, don't. Minnesota law, it's not like North Dakota. You cannot vote. It's another felony. By then it was too late. He said he had committed that act. He was very angry and upset and made the case to his probation officer, but especially to the judge who, after a lot of expense on the public's part, investigation, prosecution, time, etc., in the county jail, the judge made it clear that he believed this young man, and it turned out that other judges around the state had the same belief, that he had not been told. And so this confusion cost him and his county a tremendous amount, and it actually led to the legislature adopting some excellent legislation on a very wide bipartisan basis in the following year to put this question of notification clearly in the statute. And this is part of the legacy that brought us to this Election Integrity Task Force and to the guts of this bill, which is the process of notification, which we already see by the counties who've taken their own money, has made a difference, but also using the modern data matching electronic digital world to improve the process of transferring data from corrections and other sources of information to the Secretary of State's office for placing on the county list, the list of voters, to improve the process. So we are extremely grateful that the task force report has been so widely accepted, but also praised. It's been received a lot of support, and it has been converted into legislation that already made it very far in the House in particular last year, but also in the Senate. And we're hopeful this year that this will get your support. It'll take that support from others, and we'll be able to have these new tools to help us tackle this particular problem. We know there are some other issues that will come forward. Even in our task force, there was very strong support, but not unanimous support, for something more like the North Dakota model as something much less expensive, much more effective in a certain way. But this bill addresses those notification and that digital matching of our files across agencies in ways that we think will make an important difference in the next period of time. And we're very appreciative to the sponsor and to all of you for considering this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We'll next go to Mr. McGrath from Minnesota Majority, who asked to be heard on this bill. If you could just reintroduce yourself, Mr. McGrath.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dan McGrath, President of Minnesota Majority. I think the basic intent of House File 637 is good and useful. I think better notification of convicted felons of their voting status may help reduce the chance of our elections being corrupted by simple mistakes. If you go strictly by the results of prosecution following the 2008 election and you accept that the prosecution and ultimate convictions of people that committed voter fraud or that were accused of voter fraud for voting while ineligible, just put it in general terms, there were about 1,099 total felons that voted while ineligible in 2008. 200 of them, roughly, were convicted. So what 899 could possibly be considered to be mistakes that could be prevented by better notification. So I think there's a use to this bill, but I have some concerns, very strong concerns, about two specific areas of the bill and some less less pressing concerns about Section 6. But I'll go first to Section 2, which has the apparent intent to reduce the offense of intentionally registering a person who is not eligible from a felony to a misdemeanor. There's no need to reduce the penalties for mistakenly registering to vote because there is no current penalty for mistakenly registering to vote while ineligible. The law currently requires intent for a conviction. As I mentioned, we found over 1,099, or about 1,099 felons who voted in the 2008 election. 200 were later convicted. Most of them never charged because intent couldn't be proven that they knowingly voted while ineligible. I suspect that our work had at least a little bit to do with the creation of this legislation. I've had pretty extensive experience with the practical effects of Minnesota Statutes 201 that govern voter eligibility. I'll be happy to expand on this if the members have any questions after my testimony. Under the existing statutes, only people who intentionally register or knowingly vote while ineligible are guilty of a crime. Most importantly, please pay particular attention to the fact that this section of the bill doesn't just affect felons. It deals with any individual who causes or attempts to cause the name of an individual who is not eligible to become registered to vote. For example, this will also impact people who are not mentally competent and people who may be trying to take advantage of them for purposes of voter fraud. It would reduce the penalty for someone trying to use a mentally disabled person to commit voter fraud from a felony to a misdemeanor. I think if you're deliberately trying to register someone who is ineligible to vote, that should be a felony. But the way this is written, it would reduce that crime to a misdemeanor. Because this section of the bill is tampering with a statute that doesn't just deal with the actions of a voter, but anyone who intentionally causes or attempts to cause an ineligible voter to be registered. A person who, perhaps in pursuit of a voter fraud scheme, causes the names of ineligible persons other than themselves to be registered would no longer be guilty of a felony if this bill is enacted. Because intent is required for a crime to be present, Section 2 as written does not accomplish what I believe the authors intended it to, and it should be stricken from the bill. Amending the section to comport to the apparent intent would actually serve no real purpose, however, since it is not presently a felony or a crime at all to mistakenly register to vote while ineligible. All this section accomplishes in practical effect is to reduce the penalties for people who are intentionally doing something illegal to affect our election process. Please read it carefully. Section 4 of the bill takes the responsibility to investigate and charge voter fraud away from the county attorney. This has big ramifications. It will ultimately make investigating and prosecuting voter fraud optional. And with no one person responsible, there's no one to be held to account. Right now, it's a crime for a county attorney to not take action on fraud, and from my experiences, I believe that's the only reason many of the cases that resulted in conviction after 2008 were ever even charged. This radical change could lead to politically motivated selective prosecution of voter fraud. It will assuredly lead to lax and inconsistent enforcement, and the public or individuals lodging voter fraud complaints will have no recourse. Because failing to faithfully investigate and prosecute voter fraud has political ramifications that can affect election outcomes and shake voter confidence in the system, it should remain a crime. The buck has to stop somewhere. Some identifiable official must be responsible for investigating fraud complaints, and there must be a mechanism to hold that official accountable if, for political or other reasons, they fail to uphold the law. I realize that this is very different than how investigation and prosecution is handled for other crimes in the state. But voter fraud is an entirely different kind of crime. The legislature, I believe, had very good reasons to put this on the county attorneys, and I think it's very dangerous to remove that safeguard. County attorneys can and have delegated investigation duties to law enforcement professionals, and they are only under obligation to charge election crimes upon finding probable cause. As I said, though, where the crimes have political implications, someone must be accountable. Section 4 also allows the American Bar Association to write Minnesota's election law, and it could change. They could decide to change the process, what is the standard for investigation and prosecution. And that would be hard-coded into our law now, what a National Attorneys Association thought we should do. So Section 4 should be struck from this bill. It's not even related to the bill's intent of notifying felons on their status of their voting rights. Section 6 has the apparent intent of making prosecution of ineligible voters easier, but I'm not sure it's sufficient as written to accomplish that objective. The most difficult task for prosecutors is proving knowing intent to vote while ineligible. The standard for conviction is ineligible voter knowingly votes. So at issue is, does the signature indicate the intent to vote while ineligible? The top of the roster contains an oath. Part of that is certifying that the voter isn't under supervision for a felony, that they're 18, etc. A signature as evidence should be evidence that they have read and affirmed the oath if this section is to have any actual effect. That concludes my testimony, but I'll be happy to answer any questions the members may have.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Why don't we go with the next person on the list, Mr. Stewart. Robert Stewart. Please identify yourself and for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thanks. My name is Robert Stewart, and I'm a PhD student at the University of Minnesota. A democracy such as ours only works when citizens like ourselves or those here in the audience participate in the democratic process through participating in representative government, or as is more common, through exercising the right to vote. For that reason, I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today and to participate, because like 60,000 other Minnesotans, I'm a felon living in the community and I am prohibited from exercising my right to vote. Therefore, my only recourse at the present time to have my voice heard in government is through speaking to you here today and engaging with my legislators. Growing up in Owatonna, I was taught that the right to vote is not just an important sacred right, but it is also an integral part of a citizen's civic duty. It is through voting where we not only determine our city council members, state legislators, and national leaders, but we also vote on local tax or school referenda, and amendments to the state constitution, initiatives that any taxpaying member of any community would likely find important as they impact all members of a community. As citizens, our vote is how we take part in these decisions and how we give our say to how the government is run and how our tax money is spent. And as our civic duty, voting is the most powerful but invisible symbol of membership in our respective communities. And I realize that the topic of this hearing is the felon notification bill. And I would agree with the intent of the bill. But I would also ask the members of this committee whether that should be the focus, or whether the focus should really be on the negative impact on felon disenfranchisement. Here in Minnesota, due to our reliance on alternative sentencing measures like probation, we have the second lowest incarceration rate in the country, which is certainly admirable. However, Minnesota also has one of the highest numbers of people on probation who are living in the community. As probation sentences in Minnesota have gotten longer, those numbers continue to grow rapidly because courts are regularly handing out probation sentences of 10, 20, and even 30 years. According to the data from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, over the last decade, there have been nearly 20,000 citizens who have been given probation sentences greater than 10 years, with more than 1,000 of those given 30 years or more. In other words, this is not an insignificant number of our friends, our family, our co-workers, and our neighbors. But imagine that for a moment. Imagine being placed on probation for 30 years. The next presidential election you'd be eligible to vote in would be 2044. So since my own felony conviction, I have worked hard to turn my life around. I've earned my bachelor's degree, graduating with honors, and I'm on my way to earning my PhD. I volunteer in the community. I work full-time. I contribute to the economy, and I pay my taxes. But I'm not allowed to have any say in how that tax money is put to use. I want to participate positively and meaningfully in my community, but I'm not allowed to do so. As each election approaches, I'm relegated to the sidelines. Social conversations become consumed with which candidates people are voting for. But I am forced to admit that I am not allowed to vote, a recurring reminder of my past mistakes. And it's tough to have and demoralizing having to sit home on election day, especially when each election can mean so much. Last November's election in Minnesota was a perfect example. And I'm not alone in my desire to be able to vote. Many friends and acquaintances in similar situations and circumstances feel the same as I do. We have made our mistakes in the past, but now many of us are positive and productive members of our communities, and we would just like to be full members of the society. So I ask the committee to take a step back from this idea of felon disenfranchisement, to take a moment to consider why we use felon disenfranchisement as a punishment. Our legal system recognizes a substantive difference between imprisonment and probation. While imprisonment is characterized by a loss of or suspension of civil rights, probation or other forms of supervised release are just as the name suggests, a probationary period where a person is exposed to certain penalties like jail time and subject to a number of requirements and restrictions, all of which are generally focused on promoting the integration of a pro-social lifestyle. Clearly, voting and meaningful engagement in one's community would serve these pro-social goals. In fact, current criminological research has shown that voting appears to be part of a package of pro-social behaviors, is a symbolic form of community membership, and discourages and decreases recidivism while aiding in the reintegration of individuals into positive, productive roles into the community. And the best part about it is that it's free. It doesn't cost anything, and there's no risk to public safety. So, Mr. Chair and Representatives, as I previously stated, more than 60,000 Minnesotans here in Minnesota, or roughly the size of the city of Burnsville, are disenfranchised, and that number grows every day. So instead of focusing on how we can maintain barriers that discourage an individual's reintegration into the community, I again ask this committee to focus on what we can do to encourage reintegration and civic membership for our fellow Minnesotans. I hope the members of this committee and your colleagues in the legislature will take a serious look at felony re-enfranchisement and the positive impact that it could take or could have in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Appreciate your comments. Next up is Jim Backstrom, the Dakota County Attorney. But as he's coming on down, Representative Verdahl.
I would like him to come.
For Mr. Stewart. Question for Mr. Stewart. Representative Verdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stewart, thank you for your testimony. I should have been more aware, but had no idea that probation's lasted that long for people. How long are you on probation yet?
Until 2015.
Could you run for, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stewart, could you run for the legislature now?
No. As far as I know, I can't. I have to be able to be a voting member of society, I believe.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, in order to qualify to run for office, you have to be eligible to vote in Minnesota.
Okay. That's what I was wondering. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Was that an attempt at recruitment, Representative Erdahl?
No, it's from Otana. I think we're taken care of there.
Okay. County Attorney Backstrom, welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. I've been privileged to hold that position now for 25 and a half years. I'm here today. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of the National District Attorneys Association and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Some of my comments I will address reference both of those organizations. So I just wanted to point that out or make that clear that I may be speaking on behalf of some of those organizations as well. First of all, I want to thank Representative Halverson and the other authors of this bill for bringing this legislation forward. I want to thank the Governor's Task Force on Election Integrity for the hard work they put in to address some important and needed changes in our laws that address these issues of voting rights. And I want to thank Secretary of State Mark Ritchie for his hard work in this area. That being said, I want to first of all mention that Minnesota County Attorneys, while we're supportive of the House File 637 in general, there's a few issues I will raise, but we support this bill in general. We would like to voice our support for the what the Secretary of State Ritchie referenced as the North Dakota model legislation. And it addresses, quite frankly, just what Mr. Stewart was speaking to so articulately himself. We believe that the laws of Minnesota should be broadened and to allow anyone who's been convicted of a felony to have the right to vote once they finish serving their period of incarceration, whether it's in a state prison or whether it's in a county jail. But when they're out of jail, even if they're still on probation, they should be afforded the right to vote and the right to hold public office and many other civil rights, with the exception of the right to possess weapons. We would not support that being changed while they're on probation. So generally, we would support a broader approach to this issue. We think it would be in the interest of our communities, and quite frankly, I think it would serve to help rehabilitate offenders. So I support, as do my colleagues here in Minnesota, that aspect of the bill. I'd like to address, if I could, for a moment, Section 4 of the bill, which is the changes that deal with the requirement of county attorneys, the mandate, I should say, on county attorneys to investigate and prosecute cases in violation of the law whenever there is probable cause to initiate a prosecution. Quite frankly, Mr. Chair and representatives, that legislation violates the ethical principles, the ethical guidelines that every prosecutor in our state and in our nation is subject to. As a county attorney, we cannot ethically initiate a prosecution. Even if a police officer has probable cause to make an arrest, we cannot issue a prosecution if we don't believe ourselves that there is a reasonable likelihood of obtaining a conviction in reference to the case. So the law as it's currently written clearly violates the ethical standards that apply to prosecutions across our state and nation. So the changes here are important changes. And county attorneys also do not investigate a crime. There's only two county attorneys in the state, to my knowledge, that actually employ some investigators on their staffs. But 85 offices have no investigation support on our staffs at all, and we rely solely on law enforcement agencies to do criminal investigations. So that particular change in this bill is an appropriate change. In reference to the last clause in this bill, which is added, that references the American Bar Association's criminal justice section standards regarding the prosecution function, I would request, and my association would request, that you make the same change that the Senate made in connection with this bill when they considered it at their hearing, and that is to refer to the National District Attorneys Association prosecution standards. This is the document that's been drafted by America's prosecutors that addresses the functions of charging and reviewing cases, and we would request that that reference be changed to the National District Attorneys Association prosecution standards. And I can leave a copy of that with Representative Halverson if she would like to have that document.
Mr. Baxter, a question. Could you very briefly just explain the distinction? Why is the distinction, or why would that change be important to you?
It's important because the National District Attorneys Association standards are those that have been developed by prosecutors to govern the work of prosecutors in this country. It is the organization that is most directly knowledgeable and responsible to enforcing our laws as in terms of what the requirements and the ethical standards of prosecutors are, and we believe it is a more appropriate reference rather than a much broader organization that covers many other functions and everything else. But we believe that this is the document that is the most appropriate one to refer to. If you are going to refer to standards outside of this as it relates to prosecution.
Representative Halverson, are you interested in an oral amendment to that effect? I think we can, if members are generally okay with that. This isn't the kind of, to my mind anyway, amendment that would require advance notice for the benefit of the public, given that explanation. That's why I asked the question. So if you want to make that amendment, I would entertain that amendment, that oral amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to put forth that oral amendment, and I do have language here that I can speak to.
Go ahead. I assume on line 4.17?
Recommendation. Yes. So on line 4.17, we would strike the language that refers to the Minnesota Bar Association and replace it with...
The American Bar
Association. American Bar Association. Thank you. And replace it with, in accordance with the second edition of the National Prosecution Standards published by the National District Attorneys Association.
Okay. I want to make sure that Mr. Guerin gets this. Could you read it one more time, and then I'll make sure he has it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Halvers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In accordance with the second edition of the National Prosecution Standards published by the National District Attorneys Association.
Representative Halverson, if I might recommend this, I'd be hesitant about putting a particular edition number in there. I think so that we don't have to amend the statute every time a new edition, I'm hoping you'll be open to changing your oral amendment to just say the most current edition of or something like that, whatever you or Attorney Backstrom. You know what? I'm advised by Mr. Gehring, and I will always follow his advice, that it probably is best then to mention a particular edition. And the reason for that is he explains to me, well, why don't you just explain it, Mr. Gehring? You do it so much better anyway.
Mr. Chair, it's always possible to refer to publications or documents that are approved by bodies other than the legislature, but as a legal matter, the legislature can delegate authority to change law to other bodies, and so whatever is enacted in this section of statute will be the standards as published at the time of enactment of the bill and wouldn't subsequently incorporate additional future changes without additional action of the legislature. So specifying a particular edition or particular date of the publication is just clarifies which standards will apply.
That makes sense. So, Mr. Gehring, do you have the oral amendment, as you understand it?
So, Mr. Chair, if I heard it correctly, the amendment would be page 4, line 17, delete American Bar Association Criminal Justice section, and insert the second edition of the National Prosecution Standards published by the National District Attorneys Association. So then that whole sentence would read, with the changes, if there is probable cause for instituting a prosecution, the county attorney shall proceed in accordance with the second edition of the National Prosecution Standards published by the National District Attorneys Association standards regarding the prosecution function.
Okay. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Mr. Chair, and maybe even to Mr. Gehring, you know, I'm not an attorney, so these associations don't mean a whole lot to me. I'm wondering why we need to list these specifically in this legislation. Why wouldn't we just say in accordance with Minnesota state statute? Why? Maybe there's very good reason for doing this. You know, I've been here a while. I don't know that I've necessarily seen this type of language where we're talking about prosecuting somebody, but then, I mean, it sounded like from previous testimony that, you know, attorneys are already kind of taking oaths, and when you're a part of the bar, you're already subscribed to this as an attorney. Why are we putting this in legislation? Why wouldn't we more so reference what actually does govern the state of Minnesota, which is our current statute book?
That's a good question, Representative Sanders. I will deflect it and ask County Attorney Backstrom to see if he can provide an answer, because you will, I suspect, have some insight as to why a statutory citation might not do what at least you intend to do.
Mr. Chair, Representatives. Section 201.275 or Minnesota Statutes 201.275, you could, this section could be
simply deleted from this bill. It is not going to affect the way that a county attorney would review a case to determine whether or not a felony prosecution should be initiated, because those standards are the same. We don't have standards in place in other bills or other laws that address crimes in our state that tell us how we should function. So you could, if you wish, simply delete Section 4 of this bill. With the one exception, I would say I think it's probably a good idea to have a law in place that requires the investigation to be done by law enforcement agencies, because quite frankly, we want to make sure that that is clarified in the law. But as to the prosecutions, and I also want to assure this committee and assure Mr. McGrath, who spoke earlier in connection with this, county attorneys take their obligations and responsibilities very seriously. We will always thoroughly review investigations and make the decisions as we must make as to whether we believe there's a reasonable likelihood of convicting someone with a crime before we sign our name on a document to charge them with that particular offense. As I said, that is an ethical responsibility of prosecutors, and with this change, or even if eliminating this section, it's not going to change the way county attorneys are going to review criminal investigations that relate to voting fraud.
Well, and I would just say, Representative Sanders, I don't know if you had a follow-up to that, but I do generally, just personally, disfavor references in state statute to outside organizations, and I've seen it in other committees. Sometimes I voted for them, sometimes not. My own personal preference would be, as County Attorney Backstrom says, if it were just me as emperor for a day, I would say we don't probably need Section 4. But I'm trying to strike a balance, and I know Mr. McGrath and others who are active in this area thinks it's important to have some statement in state law about what we expect of county attorneys in this area. And so I'm trying to preserve what we have so far successfully preserved in this committee, which is a rough accommodation between competing partisan or ideological interests. So in that spirit, I would entertain the naming of particular organization. And I will note that this, as Representative Halverson said, this bill is based in part on the fine work that Representative Mike Benson did last session as well. And I think he arrived at this accommodation through much the same kind of thinking. So, Representative Sanders.
Mr. Chair, if Section 4 was deleted, it still preserves the original language in statute. I mean, it's just not a part of this bill. So, I mean, I certainly, you may not be emperor, but as the chair, I agree with you, and I would be happy. I know we have a oral amendment in front of us, but I'm very in favor of just deleting Section 4 and letting current statute rule as now, and we can, perhaps continue to have the discussion, but as far as this bill goes, I don't think Section 4 is appropriate.
I guess what I meant to say, Representative Sanders, isn't some of Section 4. I meant to say that eliminating the statute contained within Section 4. Mr. Baxter.
That was the same clarification I was going to point out. My comments would be is that Minnesota Statute 201.275 should be deleted from law, and not just deleting this section, because that would leave the current law in place, which quite frankly violates ethical standards that govern prosecution. So, with the balance in place, with the authors that put hard work into this, we would support this language with the one change adding to the National District Attorneys Association. I want to be clear that that's not going to impact the way we do our jobs, adding that language in the bill.
Okay. We have the oral amendment before us. Any comments to the oral amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Backstrom, I don't know if you have anything left. I just, in the interest of time, want to warn folks, we have two more testifiers on this bill. We'll take action on it, and we have two more bills, too, and we have a half an hour.
So I have nothing further. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. Next on the list is Mr. Hasse from the Council on Crime and Justice.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I will try to be brief. I know you're trying to move on to some other bills. First of all, I do just want to
Introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. My name is Mark Hasse, and I'm the Vice President of the Council on Crime and Justice, which is a Minneapolis-based nonprofit that does programming for offenders, ex-offenders, and their families, and also victims of crime, and we work on criminal justice policy reform. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, which is a coalition of over 50 organizations that's working to make sure that people who have committed crimes or been arrested or charged can safely move on and support themselves and their families and be contributing members of society. I'll say right up front that you probably know this, that the groups I represent support what's been called the North Dakota model. Many other states have that model. I think Mr. Stewart already represented that position quite well. The only statistic I would add to that that I think might be helpful around the probation issue is if you look at the number of people currently disenfranchised and go back to 1982, from 1982 till now, the percentage of our voting age population that cannot vote has increased by over 400%. And that's an indication of, as you already heard, the increased penalties, especially for things like drugs, very, very long probation sentences. And if you think that, you know, people shouldn't vote because they've committed a crime, and that's part of the punishment, I think that's reasonable. But I think something you should think about is when they go to prison, that's part of their punishment. They can't vote then. If they're in the community, it makes sense to have them vote. And a couple other groups that support that model is our the Minnesota Corrections Association supports restoring the right to vote for those living in the community because they see it as pro-social, rehabilitative action, as well as the American Association of Probation and Parole Officers also support allowing people in the community to vote.
To the bill?
Oh, yes, the bill. There's a couple things, so I understand, and I'll echo the sentiments earlier of thanks for those who are trying to clarify the notification. I think I attended some of the task force meetings, and it became very clear through those meetings that making sure everybody knows whether they can vote or not is very difficult given the different systems, probation versus corrections. And I wanted to just give a quick example of how we found that play out. We hear from people all the time who think they can't vote when they actually can. They're confused about the law. They don't know the different states. I've talked to people who have been involved in these issues, and years later, they look at me and go, I can vote? And, of course, they're very happy to be able to do that. A very specific case is the issue of stays of adjudication on felony-level crimes. A stay of adjudication is when somebody has committed often a drug crime or first-time, lower-level offense, felony, and the court says, if you complete probation, we'll stay your adjudication, and you won't have a conviction on your record. They don't accept, the court does not accept the guilty plea, and therefore under state law it's not a conviction, so they can actually vote. However, we know that many probation officers, attorneys, judges even, don't realize that a stay of adjudication doesn't take away your right to vote. We had to actually work with Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi to represent a young woman from St. Paul who got a 5-year stay of adjudication on a felony drug possession offense, and she was told by her probation officer that she can't vote. So we had to take that case through elections law all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court. In the meantime, Ramsey County called the woman and told her they'd made a mistake. She actually could vote. We know from talking to many people this happens often. The Supreme Court did not rule on the case. However, in their order, they made it very clear that somebody on a stay of adjudication actually can vote. The problem with this bill is it doesn't solve that problem. It doesn't clarify whether somebody in a stay of adjudication can vote or not. It also doesn't solve the issue of making sure that people really know that they can vote when they can. The provision here, I think it's section 3, subdivision 2, section 1, people that just go to probation, don't go to the Department of Corrections, are told they can't vote, but as far as tracking them down on these long probation terms and letting them know when they can vote, this bill doesn't provide for that. I would love to see in all the polling places a large sign that says, in Minnesota, your right to vote is automatically restored once you've completed your felony sentence. There was just one other point on the bill that I wanted to raise, and I think the drafters may want to go back and look at this. And it's the section itself, we don't like. It's, you know, allowing intent, evidence of intent to vote just based on signing a polling roster. It makes sense that it's clear that you've intended to vote, and this is section 6, subdivision 2. If you've signed the polling roster, of course you intend to vote, but if you look at section 201.014, which is not in this bill, the language is knowingly, somebody knowingly votes. And knowingly means that you know that you weren't supposed to vote. It's a higher evidentiary standard, I think, and something for the authors to consider. So, again, thank you for your time. Appreciate all the folks trying to work on this issue. We just think there's a better way. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The last testifier is Jeff Narrowbrook from the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And I'm going to have to ask you to be brief. I'm sorry. We have other bills. And please confine your comments to the bill, not what you wish were in the bill or what this bill is not about.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Narrowbrook with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We're a statewide association of 2,000 nonprofit organizations. We also belong to the Voting Rights Coalition, which is a group working to protect and promote voter participation. Just in brief, nonprofits come at this with a bit of a unique perspective. They're really the entities in the community, often working most closely with those who've had a felony conviction, providing services, could be mental health, housing, job, training, things like that. Offering voter registration to clients is common among many of these organizations. In fact, if you contract with the state, you're required to do so. And I hear time and again staff who fear that they might encourage someone to register to vote who's not supposed to, or discourage somebody from registering who is allowed to. That's not a position we want the staff to be in or the client, and I imagine you agree. So we agree that reducing the penalties for mistaken registrations and improving notification is a needed change to the system. I won't go there, although we do support the North Dakota model and see that as a preferred path. I'll hope to come before you to talk about that eventually. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
President Halverson, any parting comments before we figure out if members have any last comments, and then we'll take a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to everybody who testified, and thanks to the Election Integrity Task Force for their hard work on this. A couple things I just wanted to circle back on so that members are really clear about the intent of the bill and what some of this does. I know that there was some concern expressed by some testifiers about moving the penalty of registering from felony to a misdemeanor, and I would just like to state again that this particular provision in law provides some off-ramps. It provides some incentives for folks not to take it further. If both registering and voting illegal are a felony, there really isn't an incentive to stop at any point once somebody has taken those steps. So it definitely makes a distinction if somebody's starting down the road of mistakenly or intentionally voting illegally, that it gives them some off-ramps so that the actual act of voting doesn't take place if the person is not eligible. I think that it's also, County Attorney Backstrom did a really good job of explaining why we need to clarify the roles for the county attorney, that the role as the county attorney is set up is really not consistent with state law, and it does need to change. And so from both a practical standpoint and just a standpoint of fairness, I think that the Election Integrity Task Force recommendations, as it's seen in this legislation, really helps move us down a path of fairness and understanding about our election processes, and I would ask for your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Halverson, for your bill today. I want to just go back and if I could, just revisit the oral amendment that we looked at on 201.275 lines. I think it's at or around 4.15 to 4.18. And the question that I have is reflecting on what we were, observation and suggestion that I'll put forward, is if we're concerned about putting specific references into statute, would we be better off putting that as a generic a statement that would violate something, and again, this is not the right wording specifically, but violates prosecutory standards in the state of Minnesota or something to that effect? Because we're going to have other bills that are going to be coming before us that we're going to have standards that are going to be tied to them, and I would want us to be consistent with the language so that we don't start setting precedent one way in one bill and one in another when we're dealing with these kinds of issues. And I think, Mr. Chair, you know some of the bills that we've heard in the committee that we've laid over that could possibly be an issue. And so I just want to bring it up before we vote on it and it gets moved out of this committee to save the legislature some time, if there is an appetite to make that some more generic language that would help us not only with this bill but with other bills that the committee may be working on in the future.
Well, from my own standpoint, Representative O'Driscoll, and I'd also defer to the author, I think if we can come up with something that is generic and that would pretty obviously capture the output of this governing body, this private governing body, I think that's a good idea. I don't know that we'll be able to do it today. Representative Halverson, although I know we don't like to just sort of move things along, this is one that I think is really correctable, if you would be amenable to it after today, assuming that it gets the support of this committee, to maybe changing to a more generic formulation.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Edgefeld, thank you for that suggestion. I think it's excellent, and I hope that I can engage Mr. Gehring in working on some language before our next committee stop, knowing that we won't be going to the General Register yet.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, the motion was for this to move to State Gov Finance?
No.
No.
To Public Safety.
Public Safety. And then just from you, the author, Representative Halverson, what is the committee path of this? If it's going to Public Safety, do you also envision it going to Judiciary? And then I assume with the blank appropriation, State Gov Finance at some point.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sanders, that is the current path that we're looking at, yes.
So it's got several stops. Any other comments from members? Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Halverson, I know that you will work on that, and at least one of those committees that was named I'll be on. And if for some reason we forget, I'll provide you a friendly reminder. How's that sound?
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, I will look forward to that. Thank you.
All right. Members, it looks like we're probably ready to vote. So Representative Halverson renews her motion that House File 637 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Public Safety. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Halverson. We're going to go next to, if he's here. Okay. We're going to go to House File 800 only because we have some folks from out of town who also want to get on the road. Representative Nelson isn't here, but I think folks know generally what this bill would do. I think we should go to the first of the testifiers, Mr. Berenson. Oh, here's Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson, great timing. Grand entrance. I'll move that House File. Okay, House File 800 be recommended pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Nelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And earlier today, you had three bills before you for individual counties to do what, as Representative Sanders pointed out earlier, that this bill does it for the whole state. Over the past few years, we've been doing these one county at a time, two, three of them every year. In your packet, there's a thing from Deb Dyson that she did a couple years ago laying this out. I believe there's 25 counties so far that we passed this for. Three more today, that's 28. At some point, where do we get to the critical mass? And this has been kind of discussed the last few years when these come forward. When do we get to the critical mass to say, well, let's just let all of them do it, give them the ability to do this on their own? And basically, that's what my bill does. Senator Pappas is carrying this bill in the Senate, and she asked me to carry it over here, which is why I'm doing it. And like I said, she pointed out to me that back when Governor Carlson was in the office, a bill similar to this passed and was vetoed by Governor Carlson. But every year since then, we get these individual county bills to do this, and we just almost automatically pass them and move them forward, and they become law. So this bill would allow all the counties to have that flexibility. So with that, I'll stand for questions. And I have Brentson here, and he speak a little bit on the bill.
Mr. Berenson, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bo Berenson. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC is a voluntary nonpartisan organization representing all 87 counties in the state. I just want to share with you AMC's strong support for House File 800 and share our thanks to Representative Nelson for bringing this bill forward. I know a lot of this discussion's already been happening. I understand you're pressed for time. I'll try to be as brief as possible. I'm sure everyone here is aware, as Representative Nelson said, that this is not a new issue. In 1967, Hennepin County became the first county to receive this authority through statute. Since then, as has been discussed, more than 20 counties have come to the legislature and received this authority. I think an important point here, and this does somewhat get to the comments Mr. McGrath had made earlier, that at this point, the vast majority of Minnesota does somewhat get to the comments Mr. McGrath had made earlier, that at this point, the vast majority of Minnesotans live in counties where the legislature has given the authority to appoint at least one, if not all, of these positions. And I think the same would be true for the position of auditor, as Mr. McGrath said, the chief elections judge in the state. Mr. Chair, I'm willing to go on with some of my testimony, but I think a lot of it's been covered. I want to be respectful of your time and answer any questions the committee might have, but I also don't want to press my luck
thank you,
taking
Mr.
up too much of your time.
Well, I know that there's an A1 amendment. Is that your amendment?
Yes, that's my amendment. That's okay. Just basically technical in nature.
Okay, I'll move the A1 amendment. Do you just want to describe a little bit more about what it does?
The A1 amendment?
Yeah.
What it does is it moves 30 days to 60 days for notification, and then just correct some language to make it consistent with what we've already done in statute with previous bills.
Okay. Any testimony or comments or questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay. To your bill as amended, I think we'll go with the next the two next testifiers have come from some distance. We have Michelle Ash from Sherburne County. Followed by Commissioner George McMahon from Chisago County. Ms. Ash.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Michelle Ash, and I'm the elected county recorder, and I have been since 1999. I'm currently serving in my fourth term. I'm also co-chair of the Minnesota County Recorders Association Legislative Committee. And finally, I'm president of MACO, the Minnesota Association of County Officers, which is comprised of both elected and appointed recorders, auditors, and treasurers, all of whom support the current law. Under Minnesota statutes 382.01, each county must have an elected auditor, treasurer, sheriff, recorder, attorney, and coroner. But since 1973, statute has allowed counties to appoint these officers only after the voters in the county approve it in a referendum or by obtaining special legislation. Most counties that have implemented changes have done so through special legislation. The Minnesota Association of County Officers opposes the bill based on the following. Our association supports Chapter 375A in its current form. There are already methods in place for those counties that wish to change elected offices to appointed. And those methods are a referendum initiated by the county board, a referendum initiated by the recommendation of a government study commission, a referendum initiated by a petition of 5% of the voters of that county, and lastly, by special legislation allowing the county to make that position appointed. By eliminating the referendum requirement, voters are denied the opportunity to exercise their voice. Because of the important issue of the changing form of local government, the state needs to leave the referendum requirement in place, or we risk devaluing the process. Some county officers are elected, while others are appointed. The choice needs to be left up to the voters and taxpayers in each individual county instead of the county board. Lastly, I'd like to address the ongoing training and education that local officers get. We have two annual conferences in which we receive training from state departments such as Department of Revenue, State Auditor's Office, Minnesota Department of Health, and also the Federal Passport Agency. We do continue to earn continuing education credits from accredited teachers. That's all that I have. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms.
Ash. We do have one other person.
Commissioner McMahon, just introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm Terry Treichel. I'm the elected county auditor treasurer in Isani County. I was first elected county auditor and took office in 1991. This is my sixth term. In 2008, I was appointed county treasurer and elected county auditor treasurer in 2010. I heard some testimony about the only qualifications you need to be is 18 years of age and registered to vote. I think if I had campaigned on that back in 1990, I wouldn't be here today. So what I did, I ran on my qualifications of having a bachelor's degree in education, and passing the CPA certificate and completing the Master in Business Taxation program. And that was the qualifications that I brought forth. But I think what helped me when I took office more than anything was the 4 months I went out talking to my constituents and campaigning. I've been a strong supporter of the election process. throughout this. I'm a co-chair of the Minnesota Association of County Auditors, Treasurers, and Finance Officers Education Committee, which includes both elected and appointed auditors, treasurers, and finance officers. Our association supports Chapter 375A in its current form, where the voters would make the decision of changing the position from elected to appointed. By eliminating the referendum requirement, voters may be denied the opportunity to exercise their voice. If the voters wish to give up electing a county official, they should be the ones to decide, not the county board. In Isani County, how I can show how this changed, when I was appointed county treasurer to make the position auditor-treasurer, the board was very emphatic that they wanted to keep things elected. Our administrator retired in 2009, and now this year it has become part of the conversation in Isani County to make them appointed. They have decided not to ask for the auditor-treasurers, but I believe the board is going to be looking tomorrow to look for special legislation to make the recorders appointed. And I guess my, you know, just in conclusion, my experience is the voters in Isani County, and I would guess in some other counties, are fully capable of making an informed decision at the polls. And I guess I would ask the committee to follow 375A, where this decision is made by the voters.
Sir, could you remind me of your name again?
Terry Treichel.
Mr. Treichel, I saw the name on the list and I assumed you were someone else. So
okay.
I inadvertently misidentified you. Thank you, Mr. Treichel. I appreciate it. Members, comments or questions? Obviously, this is a recurring issue around here. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question to Ms. Ash. You had suggested that there was the list of county officials, the coroner, etc., recorder, and the like. Are you opposed to all, or have some preferences of keeping some in statute the way that the law currently is? And I guess where I'm going, I'll cut to the chase, is in the 30 years that I've been involved in training real estate licensees in the state of Minnesota, nobody can remember who they voted for county recorder, and they are surprised that that's something that's on the list. And I don't mean to disparage county recorders in any way, but the only time that I remember a contested race in the county that I live in was when the recorder retired, and there were two deputy recorders who were, if you will, duking it out to become the next recorder. And it's just a position that's more ministerial in the maintenance of the records from what I can see. And maybe you can enlighten me if I'm missing something on that.
Thank you, Representative.
Ms. Ash.
When I listed off those different offices, I was stating that since 1973, there have been statutes changed to make some of those appointed versus elected. I'm here on representation of MACO, which is the county officers, which is consisted of county recorders, auditors, treasurers, and auditor treasurers. Those are who I'm representing today. I can speak to the fact of campaigning as a elected recorder. I did have opposition when I ran for one of my terms. I can tell you what a great experience it was for me to go out and meet and greet with people in my county, and I felt like I did a service in educating many of my voters in my county by explaining to them what a county recorder is and what a county recorder does. It was a beneficial experience to me.
Representative Driscoll, then I understand that Commissioner McMahon is here, and I'd like to hear from him, and then we do have to take a vote before the election.
Ms. Ash, I do appreciate the job of the county recorder, and for people who don't know, you and your counterparts maintain all the deeds to properties, contract for deeds, mortgage liens, tax liens, easements, and other documents that relate to the security and procurement of real estate in the state of Minnesota, and so you do have a very, very important job in the state.
Commissioner, thank you for coming all this way to testify. I don't want to shortchange you. If you can give us a couple of minutes of your perspective, that would be great. If you could just introduce yourself for the record and proceed, and then we'll take a vote, members.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm George McMahon, Chisago County Commissioner, and appointed by my county board as legislative liaison to the legislature. I'm here today to support House File 800, and I'd like to make a few comments, if I could, about the flexibility that we have as a county board in terms of this office. We've been fortunate in the last 30 years to have two people in both offices that have served very well. The unfortunate thing, and they act as more and as a staff department head as they do an elected official. And the last election, we did have a contested election for one of the offices, and that person probably wasn't as qualified as could be for the office in which they were running. And this leaves us with the question, how best can we operate our government very efficiently? Over the last 4 years, we've changed our government, we've reorganized, and we feel that this is one of the tools that we need to continue with our work as a county board. Also, we're looking at our different than what county boards previously did. We're looking at 10-year plans, and we're looking out for the future, and this is one of the things that we need to in our toolbox for the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you're in, under a time schedule, so that's it for my remarks.
Thank you for your brevity, and thanks for coming this way on
Thank you.
Snowy day to do this. Thank you, Commissioner. Members, any other last comments or concerns? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, this has been, I think, something that we've talked about, and members, I've actually voted against these in the past just because I always kind of felt like you're taking away an elected office and the ability of residents to elect somebody to an office. But I see both sides of it, and I think, you know, maybe with some more consideration, you guys might win me over. But I think I'm going to vote against it today. But it's and you know, Tori Westrom always comes to mind as somebody who gave us a 30-minute speech on the House floor every time one of these bills came up. But we'll probably miss that.
Off.
I don't think I'm going to fill his
off.
Shoes, but we'll we'll see. But yeah, I mean, I see both sides of it, but I think you know, maybe it needs a little more conversation before it gets to the floor.
Members, any other comments, questions, concerns? Thanks for everyone's patience. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I have a question. Our current law, if I recall correctly, for the public to get the referendum on to have those positions removed is only 5%. But in your current bill, you change it to 10% to bring it back. Is there a reason for that?
President Nelson.
I don't have an answer to that question. I guess I have. It was the bill was brought to me, and Mr. Brenson's waving his hand, or maybe he's got an answer to that question.
Mr. Brenson?
Well, I guess I can't speak to, Representative, I can't speak to exactly why the bill was drafted this way. What I would say, though, is with that 10% requirement, that's typically been the requirement that's put in these county-specific bills, these 20 or so that have passed over the last 30 years. And I would say that there have been several occasions where counties have received the authority from the legislature to make these appointed, had the public hearing, approved it, had a petition filed with the 10% requirement, and the voters overturned the decision. I'd also add that there have been situations where counties have received the authority, taken it back to their county, had the public hearing, heard from the public, and decided not to proceed. So I think that, you know, one of the points we make on this bill is that you really are putting these decisions in the hands of the local elected officials and the voters. And there is a lot of teeth in that provision that allows for that reverse referendum.
Representative Johnson.
I guess my concern is we already have a current statute that allows for it to be done, letting the voters themselves decide whether they want to do this. Why do you want to make it harder for them to reverse it rather than to change it?
I don't know that we have a Mr. Chair, Representative. I don't know that we have a position either way, and I think if there was an effort from the committee to lower it, I wouldn't stand opposed.
Mr. Chair, and as he stated it, when he said it, I remind him it's the way it's been set for the individual bills that have gone forward in the past. It duplicates that, and to Representative Doubt's talking about Senator Westrom, I'm sure Senator Pappas will enjoy his soliloquy on the floor when it comes over there. But as I said, this the basic question is here is every year we pass a bunch of these, and it's, again, three of them today that at some point, where do we hit the mass of critical mass that we're going to pass, let all the counties have do the same thing. So that's what this bill does. So,
okay. Members, thanks for your patience. I will renew my motion then that House File 800 be recommended pass and placed on the general register. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, before we adjourn, I just want to say thank you to Representative Lane for your patience. Things ran a little bit late. And Mr. Goldsmith as well, thank you. We will take that bill up again on Thursday. Members, it's no surprise, as in all of your committees, we have a pretty crowded agenda. Thursday, next Tuesday, and next Thursday, three more hearings until the first deadline. I'm trying to avoid, but I'm not sure if I can avoid doing at least a partial evening hearing. I really want to, but we have a lot on the agenda, so I appreciate your patience. The meeting is adjourned.